Hello, my friends, my EE countrymen. This here is Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. Now, if you've been living in a remote jungle or perhaps under a rock for the past couple weeks, then how did you download this podcast? Huh. Anyway, then you might not know about the safety issues surrounding the Boeing MAX 8 737. Now, we're not going to get into all that. I think the mainstream press is doing an okay job of all of that for now. But we are talking about the challenges of aviation design with Scott Engel from Mercury Systems. Scott and I are chatting about the coexistence of safety and security in the world of avionics and why the key to changing our mindsets about security in aviation may be tied to the reclassification of security-related failures. All right, let's go. Thank you so much for joining me, Scott.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, so first off, Scott, we are talking about aviation safety and security. But first, how exactly would you define safety and security in this context?
So in this context, safety generally implies a system that has a safety requirement for reliability. For example, in DO-178 and DO-254 nomenclature, there are five different levels of safety, from DAL A being the most rigid to DAL E, which generally is equivalent to the laboratory occupied sign. So if they fail, nothing's going to happen. But a DAL A system would be something like the autopilot. If that fails, catastrophic things could happen. Plane could be lost, the hull could be lost, and people's lives could be lost. So in those types of systems, there's much more rigor and much more defined process on how you prove that those systems are safe. And generally, these systems go through a very stringent process, DO-254 for hardware, DO-178 for software. Now, security is protecting a device from either unauthorized use or protecting the data from unauthorized exposure. So protecting that device to make sure it's what we would say available or being able to do its job. Right now, we're building systems that for avionics that are safe, but we're not really putting a lot of security requirements into those systems. And I think that's a mistake, because if a system that is required to fly an aircraft or required to going to contribute to the safety of an aircraft and it's compromised, be a hacker of some sort, a bad agent, then it's no longer safe. Right. So it's not only safety critical, but has to be security critical as well.
Okay, so as our systems are becoming increasingly connected with IoT especially, this is making both safety and security a much bigger deal, right?
I don't know that IoT is changing the safety profile, but it certainly is making security much more of a threat. There's with IoT involved in the whole entire aviation supply chain, the whole aviation, you know, from ticketing through boarding through, you know, in-flight entertainment. There are many, many more attack vectors that a potential hacker could exploit. And that's what our hackers tend to do, is they just continue to probe at every possible point that they can get access to the system to find out what vulnerabilities there are. And like I said in the presentation, they only have to be successful one time. We have to be successful all the time in thwarting all of those efforts. So it required at this point for us to start thinking about security as we're building these safety systems. And security has to be built in from the beginning. When we say at Mercury, security can't be bolted on. It has to be built in or baked in from the beginning. And that's why it's really important for us to have these conversations early on in the process. And I talked today about the ART 4671 process, about the whole process of building an aircraft, where you start very early on and you're kind of talking about what could go wrong. Right. And normally those are what could go wrong in terms of failures of a system naturally. You know, parts go bad, you know, some sort of problem in the aircraft that keeps the system from going. But security related failures are not discussed today. And that's my point, is we need to start adding those as failure cases. And because essentially all they're doing is making a system unavailable. So if we can start adding those failure cases due to security problems, then we start actually figuring out where we have to actually harden a system.
Okay, so how do you see these two domains, safety and security, being similar? Now, on the surface, they seem to be completely different, but that's not true, right?
Well, there are things that are similar. There are things that are different. And the big similarities is, one, that they're very process-driven, that you can start with the requirements and flow those requirements down from high-level requirements to low-level requirements to actual implementation concepts, whether that be in software or in hardware. And the other part that I think is very, very similar is that they both use a concept of monitoring. Now, in a safety world, we're monitoring for things just to be in the correct parameters. You know, certain flight regimes that the things will always work in, but now we also have to monitor some of the interfaces for security instances, messages that are on a bus that don't belong, that are out of bounds, that are from an unknown source and things like that. The same way we're monitoring these interfaces for safety-related issues, we have to start monitoring those same interfaces or even other interfaces that might be exposed for a potential hacker. Figuring out what those interfaces are, figuring out what an attack looks like, and then finding monitoring circuitry, monitoring software, and us to identify that and thwart it. Now, the difference that we talked about today is that a couple of things. One is that the security domain changes every day. And in fact, I use an example today that in 2015, they've had 317 million different instances of malicious software, viruses, some sort of software that had a malicious intent. That's nearly a million a day, right? So we can't go, you know, 2-3 years without updating the security posture of a device. We have to design a system that's going to allow us to update that regularly. The problem is the security world does not want to update. Right. They want to create something that, and it's safe because they have to go through a lot of testing. It's a lot of cost. And just for example, DAL-A software generally has an estimated cost of about $100 a line of code, right? So if you're going to add another 3,000 lines of code every 2 weeks, it gets quite expensive, right? So there's a little differences in that as well. The other big difference is that what happens if there's an event. In a safety event, that system might have a problem, but there's redundancy built in because that system has to function in order to keep that plane flying. Sure. Now, in a security world, if there's a compromise, a vertical interface, the general response is to shut that down. To keep it from propagating any further, we just shut down that interface. Have you ever got a virus on your computer? What's the first thing you do? You shut your computer down, right? So that just can't do that in an aircraft, or you can't just pull over to the side of the road, you know, decide, hey, I'm not going to fly until this thing is fixed, right? You have to keep going, right? So there's a little difference in how we approach it, and we'll have to continue on the safety route because that system, whether it's compromised or not, we have to get as much information out as we can. Now, we'll alert the operator, the pilots in this case, that, hey, there's potential for a problem in there. So be aware. Use your best judgment at this point to make sure that you're not relying solely on this one system. There's a lot of redundancy built into the aircraft, so make sure you check and validate the system, but you can't stop.
All right, Scott, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, we were just talking a second ago. You were in the College World Series? Tell me more about that. That is super exciting.
That was a long time ago, a little more hair ago, a little less gray hair ago. But yes, I played baseball. I paid for college through a baseball scholarship to the University of Arizona. And in 1985 and 1986, we made it to the College World Series. In 85, we were the first team to be eliminated and sent right home. But we learned a lot during that first year. And in 86, we went back and actually won College World Series. So it was quite a remarkable experience. I got to learn a lot. I think I learned more on the baseball field than I did in any classroom.
Yeah.
it's a large part of how I am now, you know, be the competitive nature.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. I got to hit off of Randy Johnson.
Wow.
It was great. It was my sophomore year. The first time I hit off him, Randy Johnson was a pitcher for USC. I played against him on a Friday night. That Monday morning, I became a much better student, which is how I ended up here, exactly. So it was a great experience.
That is super cool, Scott. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I think that's all I have time for today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Pop quiz time. Who is your dutiful EE Journal podcasting host named after? If you guessed Amelia Bedelia, you're dead to me. And no, please don't bring that up if we meet in person. Kind of a sore spot. Okay, so no, it's the more obvious answer, Amelia Earhart. My father was involved with helicopters most of my life, and even was a helicopter mechanic for a hospital in Reno when I was a kid. So when I heard some Amelia Earhart news I might have missed, folks, I jumped right on it. Now, at the center of this new Amelia Earhart news is the idea of quantitative analysis. Now, let's go back all the way to 1940. By now, Amelia and her navigator, Fred Noonan, have been missing for about 3 years. The British government, who may have been looking for Amelia and Fred in that remote western part of the Pacific Ocean, but were most likely really looking for the wreck of the SS Norwich City, an English steamer which had run aground in 1929 off Gardner Island, now called Nicu Mauroro. Now, the British government found some very interesting things on this expedition. Not only did they find a human skull, but they also found a tibia, a fibula from the lower leg, two humeri and radii, both arm bones, and two femurs. Now, those bones were sent off to be examined and measured by physician D.W. Hoodless, who was based in Fiji. Hoodless examined these bones, and for years, we have been following his conjectures about this discovery, that these bones discovered on an empty island in the Pacific were from a man, not from the world-famous female aviator. Hoodless, whether by fault or by accident, lost the actual bones themselves. But his measurements, his data, still exist. Okay, so fast forward many, many years. And by now, forensic osteology, or the study of the structure and function of the skeleton and bony structures, is a well-developed discipline, unlike in 1940 when the bones were first found. Not only that, now we have computers to help us analyze those bones. Enter Richard Jantz, a professor emeritus of anthropology and director emeritus of the University of Tennessee's Forensic Anthropology Center, and a group called the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. Now, this group of historical investigators took that information that Hoodless collected over 80 years ago and ran those measurements through a software program called FourDisk. Now, this Windows-based interactive program is specifically used to classify adults by ancestry and sex using a combination of standard measurements. So what did FourDisk find? Well, basically that Hoodless was completely wrong. Whether he was misinterpreting his measurements based on some ideal of what gender is, or whether he was looking specifically to find a shipwrecked sailor, thus threw away any other data that didn't support that claim, we don't know. But what we do know is that FourDisk, a computer program used by nearly every board-certified forensic anthropologist in the United States and around the world, found that these bones have more similarity to Earhart than 99% of the individuals in this large reference sample. Wow. So on a personal level, you guys, this study made a big impact on me. From the days of being a kid and writing my first essay about my namesake to reading as many books as I could about her going through college, this amazing woman and her mysterious disappearance have caught my attention for a long time. And maybe with a little help from 80 years of forensic study and some well-designed software, we found the answer. So, if you want to check out more information about the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, they have even more evidence of Amelia's aircraft. You got to check it out. Or, if you'd like to read Richard Jantz's paper about the forensic study of these bones, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. Our Twitter handle is EEJournalTFM. And if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. We also have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by yours truly. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of March 29th, 2019, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.